Hi, I'm David Manti with IEN, and with me today is Gordon Stiles. He's the President and Chief Technology Officer of Star Rapid. Thank you very much for joining me today, Gordon.
Very welcome. Good to be with you.
Excellent. Well, every day it seems like there are more and more case studies of companies switching to 3D printing, particularly to meet the production needs of small to mid-size manufacturing. Do you see this trend continuing, and do you believe there's a spot for 3D printing on the manufacturing floor?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, manufacturing of low volume started really back in the late 90s, particularly with, custom hearing implants and with, for example, Invisalign with their for manufacturing clear braces. And it was very, very niche applications back then. But I was actually with a company yesterday that's using 3 carbon black machines for making low volume production of polyurethane parts that are actually going into cash machines. So that was actually quite shocking and surprising to me. And I was amazed at how strong the parts were, and the precision of the parts was exceptional. And in internal applications that need high strength, I was very, very surprised at how appropriate they were for low volume production.
Okay. You had mentioned the carbons machine. Are there any other machines or technologies out there that are kind of turning your head right now?
Yeah. Mark Forged, they're doing a very relatively straightforward kind of FDM style mini printer. I think it's the Mark II, and they're doing carbon fiber. And so there's a lot of guys who need, hollow carbon fiber parts, quite small, and they don't want to go down the traditional route of layups and so forth. So that's actually quite interesting as well. I was impressed with their parts. Good precision, good surface finish, and the fact that they're hollow means you don't waste material and you don't waste time building them.
Okay. Are there any particular applications? You mentioned that there are a lot of guys looking for hollow carbon fiber parts. Any come to mind that you can mention?
Well, we actually use them actually as a way of making inserts for our silicon rubber molds. So that's one way we use it. That's not really for production, but we use it in that application.
Okay. One of the things I've been astonished with are the capabilities of desktop 3D printers and how those have continued to improve. Do you see desktop 3D printers, smaller printers, taking more business and more parts off of larger production models?
It depends what you call a desktop. I guess the mini home printers, that's one category, and then you've got what we call the office printers, and then you've got the workshop printers. So I always looked at it in those three categories. I think it's really more the sort of office printers, if you like, the sort of, they're not the tiny little cheap ones, but they cost, instead of costing just a few grand, they might cost the sort of 10 to 30, 50 grand, that kind of range. In that, what I call office range, yeah, I think there's a lot of technology coming along that can be extremely useful to low-volume manufacturers. Obviously, we hear about, desktop metal, but they weren't the first guys to do that kind of system. There's a Scandinavian company been doing it for years. I forget the name, but they just launched. But yeah, that's really helpful if you've got low-volume metal parts where you don't need 100%, 98%. Or below integrity is enough, density is enough. Also in the plastics range, like I say, carbon black, that is actually very interesting. And then of course you've got now moving into the workshop range, although some people might call it a kind of an office style printer, is obviously the Jet Fusion from Hewlett-Packard. But that's more in the industrial range. But that one actually is very interesting. I've seen so particularly in China, there are a lot of people buying a lot of those machines right now. It was a bit of a slow takeoff when they launched it last year. People were trying to figure out, where's the niche for this? What's the cost? What's the real cost for this? But now they're getting going. I have to say, some of the parts I've seen have been excellent, and a lot of interest in it in China particularly.
Okay. With some of those printers you had mentioned, are you bringing any of those in-house at Star Rapid?
Yeah, carbon black and mark forged.
Okay. How has business been at Star Rapid?
Yeah, oh, very good. Last year, 38% growth. This year, it's cooled down a bit. In a way, that's kind of been a good thing. Obviously, we're being affected by two major things. One is that over the last sort of 9, 10 months, there's been a 9% drop in the value of the US dollar against a basket of currencies. If you look at the US dollar index, so that's kind of made China slightly less competitive. It means that, given the exchange rates, Chinese goods have gone up in price by about 5, 6, 7, 8% into the United States. So that's kind of had a cooling effect. But of course, the pending trade war, that has really, really put a chill on things, frankly, and it's affecting both countries. For example, I've put on hold the purchase of any more Haas CNC machines until I know what kind of tariff the Chinese are going to impose on American goods coming into China. And obviously, going the other way, I've got customers who are also looking, thinking, well, I don't want to get slapped with 25% on stuff I'm buying from China. It might wipe out the advantage of going there. So, yeah, it's had a chilling effect both ways, frankly.
Okay, so does that leave you sort of in a holding pattern to see how things shake out?
Oh, absolutely. I think the whole world's in a holding pattern at the moment on that
Yeah.
one.
True, true. Well, getting back to additive manufacturing, what would you say? I mean, other than, the impending trade war, what are the other challenges sort of facing the industry right now?
I actually, well, okay, let's for on plastics, it's really easy actually to design for most of the 3D printing that's going on in plastics. I think where the real challenge is, and actually I think it's the bigger market at the end of the day, it might possibly be the bigger market, and that's metal 3D printing. In that market, the problem is that you can't just print anything. Whereas with 3D printing, like stereolithography, SLS, all that kind of stuff, you can print pretty much anything that's thrown at you. But with metals, you can't. There's a lot more challenges. You're dealing with metals that are at 650 degrees centigrade for aluminium, all the way up to well over 1,000 degrees centigrade for the steels and so forth. And you're talking about hotbeds, so these machines. The bed can be running at in excess of 1,000 degrees centigrade, so as to avoid warpage. And so, you're facing significantly higher technical challenges in the design of the machines and the operations of the machines. And designers are facing much more significant challenges in actually designing parts that can be made efficiently and limit the number of supports. And limit the amount of post-build finishing, for example. So I think that we need to do an enormous amount of training of designers across the world in 3D printing. And in actual fact, we're not the only ones, but we actually hold courses every 3 or 4 months. We bring in two, three, four designers, people. They might already be customers, they might not. And we actually train them how to design for metal 3D printing. They then get to design something, and then we actually teach them how to use a metal 3D printer. And when the part comes off, they take it off, they go and do the post finishing by hand or using Dremels or whatever. And they really get a fundamentally good feel for what you can and can't do with these machines. And in every case where a customer has done that course, we see a fundamental sea change in the way that they actually design things. It's a fundamental difference in the way they design their parts ready for our machines. And it's extremely refreshing to see how they suddenly get it. I mean, because it doesn't take a lot of training. I mean, you're only talking about maybe, 16 to 20 hours of training, but they get it. They fundamentally get it, and then they design beautiful parts that are easy to machine.
In your
Sorry, easy to build.
easy to build. In your experience, is it younger engineers that are taking to it quicker and coming up with more exotic parts, or is it, can anyone at any stage of their career kind of pick it up and have success with it?
Well, actually, we have inside our oldest employee is 80 years of age. He's from Scotland, a guy called Ken Adams. He's got 65 years experience in designing mold tools and making molded parts. And he's actually been involved in a conformal cooling core process that we've been implementing at the factory. So that basically means that, you know, a mold core that has these like capillary holes running through them, and it allows you to either rapidly heat or rapidly cool a core. So he's 80, you know, and he's loving it. He thinks it's awesome. And, you know, the age range of the people on the course are anywhere from, I would say, probably late 20s through to sort of early 50s.
Yeah. I mean, that 80, I mean, Ken's, he's throwing off the numbers.
Yeah, amazing. And he keeps threatening to retire, but every year that goes by, he's still there.
Oh, no. Stick with it, Ken.
Exactly.
You had mentioned the part with the rapid cooling and heating. What other parts or components are you seeing come across your desk that are, you know, have impressed you lately?
So, for example, at the back end of a jet engine, you have a very, very, very hot chamber, you know, where they burn the fuel. And the biggest single problem they've always had there is the cooling of the chamber. And we've seen some amazing parts. I noticed the other day on YouTube, I noticed that GE were doing some very, very similar parts, you know, around about sort of 10 inches square, that kind of size, with an awful lot of cooling going on inside that you just couldn't do any other way.
Okay. One of the things I was curious about is you had recently, about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer, you had changed your name from Star Prototype to Star Rapid. What caused the change?
Very simply, 13 years ago, I started the company as a one-man business in a hotel room in Dongguan, and all I was doing was working between suppliers doing prototype machining and in China and customers in the UK and in America. And we grew up as a prototyping company, literally one-offs, 10-offs, 20-offs. It was that was what we did. But over time, we morphed into a low-volume manufacturer by stealth. You know, we didn't really think about going there. We just got those opportunities and we did well doing them, and we got more business doing, you know, a few thousand injection moldings, 10,000 parts, whatever. And so it came to a point a couple of years back where we realized that two-thirds of everything we're doing was not prototyping anymore. And I said to the guys, you know, we really need to reflect that in the name. So we changed it to Star Rapid. And in China, we're actually called Star Rapid Manufacturing. So it's really just sending out a message that we're not just a prototyping company, even though we still do it.
Okay. How, like, after starting, you know, a one-man show in a hotel room, how big is the company now?
Yeah, we're nearly 300 people. We've got 65,000 square foot of manufacturing and offices. And we're doing 20 million US turnover.
Wow. Well, one of the things I was curious to ask you about is perception. So how is American leadership perceived overseas right now, in your opinion?
Oh, dear. If you want to look at good American leadership, I would suggest that you look to a guy called Titan Gilroy, who runs a company called Titans of CNC. He has his own television show, which has been running 4 years. And this guy is amazing. He is teaching people all over the world how to do CNC machining. He's a machinist himself. He's really trying to help American manufacturers, particularly, to become extremely more efficient so that they can export more and replace, shall we say, imported stuff. He even set up an apprenticeship scheme at San Quentin Jail and is now turning out dozens and dozens of ex-cons who have CNC machining capabilities, skills, and are getting employed all over the country, all over the US. So that's the kind of leadership that I think America so desperately needs in Washington. You know, people who are passionate about something real and are actually getting things done and are real leaders, people you can look up to, people like me. I'm a 53-year-old CNC machining guy, and I look up to this, I don't know how old he is. He must be late 30s or early 40s. He's got a son who's like early 20s. And, you know, he's an ex-con himself, an ex-boxer. He got into trouble. He beat someone up. He did some time. He's now friends with the guy he beat up, you know. So, but he learned his lesson. He's moved on. This is a real American story. And that actually, I look up to that guy. And I'm equally as skilled as he is at CNC. But I look up to his passion and his leadership. So I am actually personally in my life being led by a, you know, say a guy in his early 40s, ex-con in America. He's my leader. Yeah. Even though he's in America, he's my leader. And he didn't need to get elected to do that. And I think what America needs is a, you know, 1,000 people like him on the Hill, and at least one or two guys like him in the White House. That's what it needs.
Okay. At least, I mean, maybe we can increase the rate of incarceration. No.
Oh, well, you certainly need to decrease it. And I think one way of doing that is to actually, and I've suggested this to British members of parliament, is that every single prison should be turned into an apprenticeship center.
Yeah. No, that's a great idea. I definitely think that would be a better solution.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time today, Gordon. I really do appreciate it.
No, it's been wonderful speaking with you, and anytime.